When we say GMO or genetically modified organisms, what does that really mean?
GMOs is an interesting topic because it helps ward off disease and it helps provide ways for crops to not get eaten by bugs. But then in another sense, there's a whole question mark about what do those chemicals actually do to your body? How do they decompose in your body? Do they stay in your system? And that's something that I'm concerned about.
Plus,
how do you tell the story of a people who have been apart from but an integral part of America? American history cannot be understood apart from the African-American experience.
That's how one North Carolina high school explains why they teach African-American studies. Today in this era of budget cuts, we speak to professors from Chicago State and UIC about why they think their programs are important, even if their department's enrollment isn't that high. That's all this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks very much to Amanda Vinicky for sitting in for me yesterday, filling in. Earlier this summer, President Obama signed into law a nationwide GMO labeling bill. It will require all food products containing GMOs to include that language and information about it. All the details haven't been fully worked out yet. Yesterday, we asked people in the Champaign area what they think about GMOs.
I think that some GMOs probably are okay. Some GMOs make it more likely that they overspray. So like you have corn Roundup Ready, it's genetically modified. And I think some things are better left as they originally were.
You know, most of our foods have been modified by just, you know, there's hybrids. But if you're sticking in, you know, little bits of genetic material from an animal into a plant or something, you know, bizarre like that, then there's definitely more research that needs to be done.
I guess I don't have much of an opinion about it, really. I hear a lot of talk about it, but I'm not all that informed.
Yes, I understand there's a lot of science support the fact that GMOs are safe. But at the same time, why do we look ahead and think, you know, 10 years from now, are we going to be pulling this because we've discovered that there was something we didn't know? So I think better safe than sorry.
We're not getting the whole story as far as the research, you know, the peer-reviewed studies, that kind of thing. I think you get to really investigate that further and where's the money coming from, that kind of thing.
Thanks to producer Christine Herman for that, talking to people in Champaign about what they think about GMOs. We heard a lot of opinions in there, and including one man who said he felt like he wasn't particularly informed. Well, today we're talking about what GMOs actually are. If you have a question or comment about this, you can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show, 21ST Show. Later, we're going to be talking about some new technology editing genes inside a plant that would, for example, produce higher yields. But first, we're joined by Nathaniel Johnson. He's a food reporter for The Grist, a nonprofit online magazine that focuses on environmental news and commentary. He's on the line from California. Hey, Nathaniel, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, great to be here.
First of all, let's start with a very simple question. How do you define GMOs, Nathaniel?
Well, it's
doesn't have a simple answer.
Like a simple,
right, exactly.
Yeah, there's not a simple answer. I mean, I think that what the popular definition of GMOs is, people think of GMOs and they think of something that that people have tweaked in the lab, where the genes have been altered in one way or another. The narrowest definition of GMO is any kind of organism where you've taken genes from one organism and put them into another. You've done transgenesis. You've moved genes from one thing to another. But of course, you know, there's lots of other ways to modify. You can just sort of scramble the genes up a little bit with radiation and see what happens. You can go in and turn some off without actually moving genes from one species to another.
And people have been genetically modifying crops for millennia, right, if we're talking about the broadest sense. But when the technique of inserting DNA into a plant led to the first genetically modified crops in the 90s, this is when we started seeing headlines and uproar about all of that. I wonder, what's the difference between what scientists have been doing recently in the past 20 years or so in a lab between what farmers have been doing for centuries?
So there's... There has been, I had this perception that farmers, you know, that what we saw here was a real quantum leap, that we'd seen farmers in this slow co-evolutionary process with the seed, making changes and then adapting to the system-wide changes that they saw on the farm and choosing the seeds that were best for that. And in reality, that sort of thing is about a century out of date. And there's, you know, farming and seed breeding had moved in, has moved into the lab, you know, really 100 years ago with all sorts of techniques that don't involve necessarily moving genes from one species to another, but do involve things like cloning and culturing a little bit of tissue from a plant and growing that into its own plant and using the mutations that arise from that. So we really have, we've been on this process of moving away from just the farmer picking the seed for a long time. And that was sort of one of the big wake-up calls for me when I was studying this, is that I thought it was, you know, this big switch. And in reality, it's been this long technological process, and this idea of moving genes from one thing to another. You know, I think that we just, as a United States people, started to become more interested in farming around the time that this was happening. And we saw at that time, oh, this is the latest technique. And that's why the interest is focused in on that.
I'm speaking with Nathaniel Johnson. He's a reporter for Grist.org. They're a nonprofit online magazine that focuses on environmental news and commentary. We're talking about GMOs. We know that lots of people have questions or comments about this. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. Again, that's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet as well to 21st Show. And Nathaniel, you said you're indicating sort of that you had, when you first started reporting on this, maybe you had a different opinion or understanding of GMOs. How has that changed as you've been reporting on this issue?
Well, there was my when I started out, my opinion was pretty similar to one of the people that Christine interviewed for the beginning of the show, who said, you know, there's a lot of science on this suggesting that it's safe, but, you know, what if we find something 10 years from now that didn't show up in our studies? Better safe than sorry. We might as well just avoid it. And that's basically how I thought of it. You know, I didn't see any real benefit from this, and there was this potential for unknown risks. And so that's how I started going into it.
And what do you think now?
Well, I think, you know, now I've come to see that there are real benefits for the people that use them, for farmers. And there's also been some benefits in some of the GMOs for the environment. And so, you know, I wouldn't call myself pro-GMO any more than I'm pro say dishwasher, but you know, it is a technology that has its use, and if we pick the ones that are really useful, I think it can be beneficial.
We're talking to Nathaniel Johnson. He was on earlier this summer when we were talking about GMO labeling and the bill, and we realized that lots of people have even more basic questions about, but labeling aside, just what GMO means and what it the implications of it are. So we have him come back. We're talking about that now. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to Paul in Urbana. Hey, Paul, welcome to the 21st. What's your question or comment?
Thank you very much. Well, when you were on the last time, Monica Ng was on, and I shared her distress about the lack of longitudinal studies, and it got to be kind of contentious with the straight-up scientist that was on, not the journalist, but that studies have been done. I don't think they have been done sufficiently, because it's not so much what it will do to any individual for eating GMO foods or not. It seems to me that there's unintended consequences that come with having these genes sort of tailored into something else, the fact that they could spread into other things. There's been some examples of that already, where I think there's some evidence that some resistance to particularly pesticides has spread into the weeds that they were actually designed to, or herbicides, I guess it would have been.
Okay.
But sort of more of the unintended consequences.
Sure.
I think with the corporate dominance of the academy as well, and the way that the funding is done, I don't think the longitudinal studies will be done. So I think we ought to have a moratorium on any widespread use of it. And it certainly hasn't, the yellow rice, the vitamin A rice, has certainly not done what it was sold for. And
thanks for that, Paul. Thanks for that comment. There's a couple things that Paul had in there, Nathaniel. Let me start with the first comment about just funding. And actually, let's start with the broader comment about long-term effects. And Paul was raising the issue of no longitudinal human studies. And I remember we talked about this before. Nathaniel, do you feel like there's been sufficient longitudinal research on this issue?
I do. There's with any assessment of risk, there is going to be different goalposts that different people will want. And the goalposts that were set originally, we've reached. And of course, there's always going to be people who will want to move the goalposts and
what were those goalposts then? When you say that goalposts have been reached, what level? I mean, I guess my question is to what level of safety are we looking at? Because I guess it's sort of a broader philosophical question that I think Paul is raising that a lot of people seem to have objections to, which is, we don't know what we're doing. What are the unintended consequences of this? And what's your response to that?
Right. So I mean, this is real question with any new technology, right? That anything that we introduce, be it a new microchip, a new form of Wi-Fi from our computers to our phones, you know, it might do something to us that we didn't expect. And so how much should we slow down innovation in order to make sure that something bad doesn't happen? There's a real trade-off that we have to weigh there. And so what they decided to do with this was to see if they could figure out if it was equivalent to the plants that were there beforehand. So you go through, you test all the chemicals that come out of a plant that's natural. You do the same thing with the new transgenic plant, and you see if they're the same. So that was the first thing that they did. They were, and you know, when they found that they were the same, they moved forward with it. Mm. They also did testing, feeding animals of these various different plants to see if there are any changes in the animal health. And then they've also followed up with long-term analysis of populations of people that, like in the United States, where we eat a lot of genetically modified foods versus populations elsewhere where they don't, to see if there's any emergence of health trends in one group or another.
And Nathaniel, what about? Go ahead, finish that. Sorry, go ahead, finish that thought.
And all of those have suggested that there's not a cause for concern with this technology.
And what about to Paul's other point, though, about corporations and funding and how much of the research is being funded by companies and I think Monsanto comes up a lot in here, other massive agribusiness companies that have a vested financial interest in promoting GMO crops. What about that point?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this is, you know, when Paul was speaking there, he brought up about six different topics, and I think this is one of the real ones that really is behind a lot of the concern about GMOs. It's that here's this new thing that you're asking me to accept. I don't really see any benefit in my life from this personally. There may be risks that we don't know about, and look, the benefits all seem to be going to this big corporation. Why should I be asked to take some risk, even if it's, you know, just this hypothetical sort of sci-fi risk, to fill the pockets of this big corporation that I don't like? And I think that's the real issue here, that this technology has largely been dominated by large corporate seed companies. There are examples of the technology being developed by, you know, nonprofit public universities. That's the papaya that is disease resistant, that's being used in Hawaii, that's been a real success. And you see this in development of crops in other countries, eggplant in Bangladesh that resists pests, seems to be a real success. They're working on cassava and bananas in Africa. So there is more and more coming out of the academies and the nonprofits, but it doesn't change the fact that up till now, you know, the vast majority of the GMOs that we've seen have come from these for-profit corporations.
We just have about a minute before we're going to take a break. I want to ask you really quickly about one of the things someone, when we spoke to people yesterday, he was talking about adding animal DNA to crops. Does that happen?
That is a good question. I'm not totally sure. Every example that I can think of is, it doesn't happen. It's
there are bacterial additions, right? Maybe, but maybe
bacterial
not.
Bacterial or from one crop to another crop. I can't think of an example of, I mean, there's things that have been considered but haven't actually been used and put into application. I can't think of any example of animal DNA being added to a crop.
When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Nathaniel Johnson. We're going to keep taking your calls and tweets, 1-800-222-9455. You're listening to The 21st. We're talking about GMOs. Stay tuned. Welcome back to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about GMOs. We're taking your calls and tweets about it, 1-800-222-9455. With Grist Nathaniel Johnson, you're welcome to call in with questions or comments. Nathaniel, we just got a tweet from Claire saying that GMO products like, and she was mentioning one, it's called Aqua Bounty Tech. She says that goes through the same regulatory process as medical drugs. Is that true for most genetically modified organism, like crops? Do they go through that kind of regulatory process?
They don't exactly go through the same process. They are they do go through this intensive consultation with the Food and Drug Administration, which is the same agency. But it's not exactly the same. It's similar to the drug approval process in that there's this series of tests that the government requires companies to do prior to approval. The government monitors those tests and, you know, goes back and forth with the results to see if it can get approval or not. And it often takes, you know, a number of years to get through.
One of the other questions that one of the people we spoke with in Champaign yesterday was concerned about a link between a pesticide and Roundup. Is there a link there? Because I know that we've had the World Health Organization sometimes giving us different information about that, whether there is a link between the pesticide and cancer.
So there's a couple things to say here. First of all, the reason that would be interested in Roundup or it's now off patent. So Roundup is the brand name that Monsanto makes, but lots of other people sell this chemical as glyphosate. And that's a weed killer. It's super effective. It's very cheap. And so what happened with the World Health Organization is that there's a small group within the WHO that assesses whether different things can cause cancer in a worst case scenario. So the purpose of this group is to be like, can dropping a rock on your head kill you? And they don't ask whether, you know, the rock is 1 pound or 100 pounds. They don't ask if it's dropped from 1 foot or 1,000 feet. they ask, you know, in any situations, can this be a problem? And what they determined was that glyphosate could be a potential cancer risk if, you know, you had massive amounts applied directly to cells. Excuse me. There's another organization or another group within the WHO that takes that information and asks, you know, are these things real world cancer risks in the amounts that they're used, in the amounts that people are exposed to them? Are they likely to cause cancer? And in that case, the World Health Organization said, no, it's not. So,
but I think oftentimes people see headlines, right? They see the headlines and maybe aren't paying as close attention, or they see one headline and then they don't see what happens a year later.
Yes, of course. Of course. And, they, you know, because just sort of what's out there in the culture is that GMOs are bad and, you know, pesticides are bad. And so it's, we're more alert to the things that jibe with our preconceived worldview. And so we see this headline about the WHO risk assessment group saying that glyphosate is potentially cancer causing. But we don't see the other one about the WHO as a whole saying it's not a cancer risk.
That's Nathaniel Johnson. I want to bring someone else into this conversation. Lanisha Massenburg is a graduate student in the Department of Plant Biology at the University of Illinois. She's working on some newer technology for editing genes inside a plant to make it more efficient. For example, to make a plant produce higher yields. She's in studio with me here. Lanisha, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
What do we mean by gene editing, first of all, before we even get to what the kind of things you're working on?
Okay, so gene editing is now focusing on only the plant gene. And what you're doing is taking little pieces of the gene that's already in the plant and you're changing it in a way that will give you a new appearance or a desired trait, or such as higher yields, et cetera. And so,
what kind of changes can you make to a plant by editing their genes?
Right, and so you can actually change little bits of the gene that would then go to the protein level, where you're not making as much of a gene, which means whatever you are changing is going to change the plant as a whole, mm-hmm. just from these little changes within the gene. You can also take out the whole gene, just take it out completely. So then there's no protein, no anything going on.
And in your research project, you're actually looking at an ancient plant.
Yes.
Why are you doing that?
And so I'm looking at an ancient plant because I'm curious if genes in the ancient plant actually behave similarly to crop plants. And so maybe I can actually unlock clues to higher efficiencies. Maybe the genes actually work better in these ancient plants.
And what plant are you looking at in particular?
In Marchantia polymorpha. So it's a liverwort plant.
A liverwort plant, which still exists today, but is one of the sort of original plant lives that existed on Earth.
Yes.
And how do you think this could be adapted to working with crops, for example, or current day plants?
And so the beauty about working with CRISPR-Cas9 is that whatever system you design, you can just actively apply it to whatever plant you want. And so if it works in the ancient plant, then you can use a very similar design to shift it immediately to crop plants.
So what you're saying, CRISPR-Cas9, that's the gene editing, CRISPR-Cas9, that's a gene editing technique. And I know that researchers, for example, from the University of Pennsylvania, use this to create a mushroom that doesn't turn brown as quickly. Do you consider this genetically, would you consider this then genetically modifying? I mean, you are literally modifying the genes, but would you put this in the category of GMO?
And so this is where it gets a bit interesting, because the genetic modification actually happened from the plant itself. It actually modified itself. And so now...
And you're not taking genes from another plant or another organism and putting them in.
Yes, because the plant has a repair mechanism within itself to repair the DNA. And during that time, you can actually change the DNA a little bit. And this happens naturally within plants.
Nathaniel, when we're thinking about this sort of new frontier of gene editing within plants, and working to either, you know, as we're saying with mushrooms, maybe they won't brown as much. With other crops, maybe they'll have higher yields. I don't know if you consider this genetically modified organisms. And then I can think my broader question is, does the government, would this fall under the same category of regulatory and labeling that we've just been talking about?
It currently doesn't. It doesn't. This goes through different channels, and it's considered more like a seed that's been produced by older methods rather than transgenesis. So this is one of these really interesting things because it's more about culture and values than science. When I first saw this, I thought, well, you know, the people who are against genetic modification, you know, will still be against this sort of thing because it's just, it's even more high tech. If you're still modifying genes, you know, you're not moving them from one thing to another, but it's still scientists doing it in lab coats. And some people I talk to feel that way, but there's a lot of people who don't. And, you know, I noticed on when I was on last time, and when this comes up in popular culture a lot, there's a lot of people who really are bothered by the idea of genetic modification, who say, like, this sort of thing, of course that's not genetic modification. This it's very easy to define genetic modification as a strict definition. It's moving genes from one species to another. If you're not doing that, don't have a problem with it.
How much of this, Nathaniel, do you think is about our philosophy about this or the stories that we attach to it? This is such a passionate issue. I think people have such strongly held beliefs on this, regardless of where they stand on this issue. How much of it do you think is just about the stories that we've decided we're going to, the way we've sort of already, I guess you're saying we've already maybe some, in some ways we've already decided how we feel about the issue.
I'd say like 90% of this issue is about that. It's about, the psychology of people and about our tribes too. We look around to the people that we trust and see how they're reacting to it and say, is this a conservative issue? Is this a liberal issue? Which side should I fall depending on the people that I tend to be around? Which side are they choosing? And I'll choose that same side. We really see that sort of alignment happening with a lot of new technologies.
And I wonder, I wanted to ask you, Lanisha, you're someone who is working in plant biology. Your dad was a farmer, so you sort of grew up with plants and your father sort of teaching you what he learned as a kid on his farm. Where do you stand on what you think about, let's take the gene editing out, but where you think about this broader conversation we've been having about GMOs and safety? Do you consider yourself pro or against?
And so I'm actually impartial for GMOs, even though I've been studying it for a very long time. And the reason is because it is a tool that does need investment in terms of taking the time to get to know what it is, et cetera. It's a tool that can be used among many other tools in a toolbox for plant improvement.
And I think people tend to make decisions based on all kinds of factors when they're thinking about buying into GMOs, buying this. And I think there be plenty of people who always want to buy non-GMO foods, however we're defining that. Where do you see, Nathaniel, where are you seeing sort of a marketplace for non-GMO? Do you sort of see this along the lines of it's the same as a marketplace for organic or other sort of green ways of thinking and buying?
It's interesting. There's actually some competition between the marketplace for non-GMO and for organic. Of course, organic excludes GMOs as they're popularly defined. So if you're buying organic, you're buying non-GMO. But there's a lot of people who are going out and purchasing things don't know that, and so they see non-GMO, and they just think of it as a sign of like this must be better in some way.
It must be sustainable or environmentally friendly.
It must be more sustainable, yeah. So we've seen some evidence that people, you know, who would otherwise buy organic are saying, oh, I'll get this non-GMO labeled thing, which is, you know, in many cases it's really silly because you see these labels popping up on all sorts of things that don't, you know, have GMO alternatives like salt and kitty litter and things like that.
And do you think that organic and the label organic is as clearly defined as GMO?
I'd say it's more clearly defined in a lot of ways. There are real standards, and there's a board that meets every year and adjusts things. The organic label isn't perfect, I think, but there is a real clear definition as to what it is.
And when I ask you all of this, I know that in the end, it's very interesting as someone who's reported on this and studied this. I wanted to ask you about, it seems like such a passionate thing, but in the end, you've said that you don't think it matters very much what actually happens if GMOs are completely banned or if they're promoted or accepted worldwide. Why would you say that?
Well, so I think I wrote a piece making that argument, and of course, immediately alienated everybody. The people.
I was going to say you alienated all of your readers, right?
And all the, you know, all the plant scientists who have devoted their careers to trying to use this tool to make the world a better place. And I think what I'm trying to say with that is, in the really big context of things, in the kind of global fate of humanity scale, if we stripped out this one particular technology, yes, it would slow down the improvements that we can make in food and farming, but we'd figure out other things and we'd move on. If we took it out, though, it wouldn't cause massive changes in our technologies. You know, people associate GMOs with industrial farming, but industrial farming was around in the early 90s when this was introduced. In many ways, our farming system was a lot less sustainable than we just see some revision. We'd see some changes. We'd probably see less spraying of glyphosate, but more spraying of other herbicides. We'd see less use of these insect-resistant GMOs and more spraying of insecticides.
That's interesting. Lanisha, do you agree with that?
Not 100%. However, I do know where he's coming from, and I definitely agree on some points. My point of contest is for yields. A study, actually Purdue University is working on looking at that question exactly. What would happen if there were just no GM plants at all? And they found out that you do get a yield reduction. And I think have some economic model that they've developed, an algorithm that calculates what would happen considering the benefits of GMOs. If this were to be removed from our current system of food production, what would actually happen?
And interesting. Okay. Mm-hmm. We'll try to find that. We'll look for that study and we'll tweet it out if we can find it. But I want to thank Lanisha Massenburg.
I agree with that.
You agree? Okay, good. All right. And that's Nathaniel Johnson, too, reporter for grist.org. Thanks, Nathaniel. Thanks, Lanisha. Thanks to everyone who called and tweeted. You're listening to the 21st. Stay tuned. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You're listening to The 21st. Given the numerous public discussions that have been ongoing about the role of race in African Americans in the U.S., it might be surprising for you to learn that just a handful of students at Illinois public universities are graduating with degrees in African American studies. How small? According to the Illinois Board of Higher Education, from 2011 to 2014, an average of just 15 bachelor's degrees a year in African American studies were conferred to students at all of the state's public institutions. Given those numbers, the board recommended that a few schools, including Chicago State, the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and UIC, and a few other schools, put those programs under review. How much does student enrollment matter, especially when it's a subject like African American studies? We have two university department heads joining us now to talk about this. From UIC, Professor Jane Rhodes is the African American Studies Department head, and from Chicago State University, her counterpart coordinating the program there is Professor Kelly Harris. Thanks for being with me, both of you.
Glad to be
here. Thank you very much.
Professor Harris, let me start with you. Do you think interest in African American studies has waned in recent years? When we look at the numbers, it certainly seems that way.
Well, it's always been a tough road for us because African American studies has always had different misconceptions about exactly what the major is and what you can do with the degree. So that's always been a challenge in terms of numbers. So we've never had the most majors on campus or anything of that nature. As a matter of fact, Chicago State and recently has had the most majors that we've ever had in African-American studies. And our numbers are comparable or better than what you see at historically black colleges and universities, who you would think would have even more majors, such as Morehouse.
Right.
And Howard University, which is the largest university, Howard University doesn't even have 40 majors. So that's a part of the, you know, challenge just for African American studies being in higher education.
Professor Rhodes, would you say the same is true at UIC when you look at your numbers over the years?
Yeah, the numbers have ebbed and flowed over time, and we've definitely seen a decline in the last 10 years. And I think I would argue that a lot of it has to do with the emphasis on tying a career to an academic major. You know, so we hear this all the way from the President of the United States down to state legislatures and communities, public schools. Everyone assumes that there has to be a direct sort of career relationship with an academic major. And I think, as Professor Harris says, there's a lot of misconceptions among students about what kind of career you could have with a degree like this.
That makes a lot of sense, Professor Rhodes. And I wanted to ask you about that because I think there is so much an emphasis given also, I think also just the facts of how expensive a college degree is and students thinking about the investment they're making, how much they're going to be paying back in loans or what their earning potential is as soon as they're done. I wanted to ask about, and Professor Harris, you talked about this a little bit, just about maybe people not understanding what careers they could have. What do you, Professor Rhodes, what do you say to students in terms of what kind of jobs that they would be looking at or what kind of career they would be looking at if they were African American studies majors?
Well, I take a sort of different tact, which is I say to students that the reality is data shows that most college students do not end up in the career that's designated by their major. Now, this data shows that within 5 years, most people have gone on to different fields or different majors. That's true for the baccalaureate degree. It's, of course, different if you go on to law school or medical school or something like that. So, this is true if you're a sociology major. This is true often if you're an education major. So it's no different in African American studies. There isn't a degree that guarantees you a job after graduation. And so I think we do a real disservice to students to suggest to them that there is a career and a dollar sign attached to an academic major.
Right. And I think certainly when you're talking about different liberal arts degrees, it sounds similar to, as you said, English or other sort of. Right. Professor Harris, what do students say to you? What reason do they give for wanting to, for the majors that you do have? As you said, you all have seen bigger numbers than you've ever had. What are they saying about why they want to study in the field?
Oh, well, it's empowering for them. And a lot of my students are double majors, but they feel empowered by the information that they're learning, because one of the skill sets that you have to have in going for a job is critical thinking. And, you know, African American studies has always pushed for critical thinking and analysis and understanding and locating problems and coming up with solutions. So our program challenges our students to be very solution oriented. And partly because of what's happening in Chicago and around the world with Black Lives Matter movement, we see a lot of students who are really engaged in what's going on in the city. And they feel as if this major can help them navigate what they're doing out in the community and help them locate solutions and really think deeply about solutions to the problems that our community faces, not just here, but, you know, on a global scale. So many of our students have gone on to graduate school, and whether it's African American studies or political science or different things of that nature.
Well, and as you're saying that, Professor Harris, I mean, both of you work in Chicago, and I'm also just thinking about not just the demographics of the city of Chicago, but also your schools. Your schools have some of the highest numbers of students graduating with these degrees, both UIC and Chicago State. They also have some of the largest concentrations of Black students, and I'm thinking Chicago State. Your student population is about 60% Black, Professor Harris, that's correct?
At least, yes.
At least. And are the majority of students enrolled in the African American Studies program, are they African American?
That's correct.
And is the same true for UIC, Professor Rhodes?
No, on either count. We sadly are not doing as well as we should in recruiting African American students. We only have about 9% of our student body is African American.
And are the majority of students who are enrolled in the African American Studies program at UIC, are they African American?
Yes, about 80% of our majors are African American or of the African diaspora. There's also many students who are African immigrants, for example.
Professor Rhodes, do you think that administrators on campus are doing enough to communicate the value of African American Studies program and to appeal to more students?
I think administrations could certainly do more. I do think there are efforts to do that, and that there's a recognition that there's a connect. If we want to recruit more African-American students, African-American studies is one way to do that, because we do, as Professor Harris said, provide a sense of empowerment and knowledge for many Black students. But I think, you know, it goes back to my earlier comment about sort of the rhetoric of college educations. I think public universities want to sell, sort of an economic gain of academic mm-hmm. degrees, and administrators then promote career programs that they think are going to do that.
Professor Harris, do you think I'm curious your thoughts about Chicago State University. And obviously, I think it's hard, as we're hearing Professor Rhodes speak, it's really hard to have this discussion about Chicago State without talking about the budget situation and the financial
right.
issues that the university is facing as well.
Right, right. Well, you know, we really don't cost the university anything. So that's what we found out, you know, because a lot of programs had to go because of IBHE's insistence on graduating, how many students graduate, we had to go in front of the cut committee, program elimination committee, and we had to justify our existence. And the committee, you know, said, one, that we do more than any other field on campus, discipline on campus. Two, we cost the university the least amount of money. And partly that's because the university has not supported the program in a manner that could make it more successful for students. And what I mean by that is this. I'm the only full-time faculty member in African American Studies. So if for me, when you want to support a program, you give the faculty support that the program needs to have different course offerings for students and majors. And we haven't done that at this university, and that's something that we really need to work on.
Well, Professor Harris, when you have to go before these committees, and as you said, the cut committee, and you have to justify your existence, what do you say?
Well, we have been able to say is look at the number of students who are enrolled in our classes. Even considering the size of our program, you know, in the last 10 years, we've expanded the number of course offerings that we've had because there's a demand for students taking our classes, not majoring now, but taking our classes. So our classes are very popular with the students. So that's one thing. Two, with the number of majors that we do have, we generally graduate our majors within 4 to 5 years. So that's another positive for the program. Three, our engagement with the community is extremely strong. And we've been able to hold different forums that bring the community to the campus. And so we've really been on the forefront of strengthening the ties between the campus and the community. And we've, you know, some have been very high-profile things, like we've had two mayoral debates. We had a state's attorney debate. So those kind of things really highlight the work that we're doing in African American Studies and show the value that we bring to the university.
That's Professor Kelly Harris talking about Chicago State University. Professor Jane Rhodes is also with us. She's a department head of the Professor of African and a Professor of African American Studies at UIC. I should mention we reached out to both UIC and the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. We got a response back from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign saying that, yes, they know that there has been a recommendation for review. The university's response at Urbana was that we feel like we're going to tell them that the numbers, there are other effects of this program that justify its existence apart from enrollment. And one of those things that they mentioned at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign was the introduction of a general education requirement for all students, which focuses on minority culture in the U.S. So I wanted to ask you, Professor Rhodes, about is certainly I'm not sure what's happening at UIC with their gen ed requirements, but at University of Illinois, if they're requiring all students to be taking more coursework, including within the Department of African American Studies, is that something that you sort of see a broader place that it's important for all students, regardless of whether or not they're majoring and whatever their background is, to be taking coursework in the department?
Absolutely. You know, when you opened the show, you were talking about the relationship between the kinds of racial crises going on in the U.S. and around the globe and these programs. And I think that's a service that we provide. Professor Harris was just talking about that, that doesn't get recognized in these numbers of when you're only calculating the number of majors that you have. Our classes are almost 100% full every semester. Students are clamoring. Students from every racial background, every ethnic identity are clamoring to take our classes because they want to understand what's going on, whether it's in the city of Chicago, whether it's across the U.S., whether it's around the world. And I think we provide that education and training. We provide a deep historical understanding of race in America. We provide people with the analytical tools. We send students who are going into education and medicine and social work and a variety of other fields. We give them a kind of context and understanding so they can make sense of everything from the presidential election to what's going on in their own neighborhoods. So this is a value that I think is irreplaceable, and that comes under the rubric of the general education requirements. And yes, we have a number of general education courses that we offer, and we've been offering them for a long time.
One last question for you, Professor Rhodes. I sort of feel like you've consistently pushed back against the notion, as I think a lot of academics would, looking at the value of a program by simply the majors that they're offering. Do you feel like given the current budget situation, that's more and more of the environment we're seeing at state universities?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I think all of us are cognizant of the economic crisis, and we're willing to do what we have to do, you know, trim budgets, you know, take the hit, because everybody's taking the hit, and we're certainly not immune from that. But I do think the history of our programs, Black Studies and African American Studies, is that we've always been underfunded. We've been underfunded, 25 years ago, and so programs that have always struggled at this point are really at a bare bones situation. There's not much more that you can take away without just eliminating the programs altogether.
Jane Rhodes is the Department Head of African American Studies at the University of Illinois, Chicago. I want to thank her along with Professor Kelly Harris. He's coordinator of the African American Studies program at Chicago State University. Thank you both for being with me.
Thank you for inviting me.
That does it for us today. Tomorrow on the 21st, we're going to be talking about why insurance plans through the Affordable Care Act are becoming more expensive and how that's affecting families in Illinois. We'll have a post up more details about that on Facebook later today. If you want to chime in, if you have questions you want to ask our guest, including Julie Rofner, who are going to be joining us tomorrow, find us on Facebook. Like us, search for the 21st. You can also follow us on Twitter, 21st Show, to see what we're working on. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.